if I could, just ask if they just submit a letter. You don't need to submit a regular brief, just a letter on that issue.
We'll proceed with the next case, which is LaFrancis Ross versus Joanne Barnhart. Ms. Grove?
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Tara Lee Grove, and I represent the Social Security Administration. Substantial evidence supports the determination of the Social Security Administration that plaintiff Ms. LaFrancis Ross is not entitled to disability insurance benefits or supplemental security income benefits. This court should therefore uphold the determination of the agency and reverse the erroneous decision of the district court. The district court found that in determining a claimant's residual functional capacity, an administrative law judge cannot reject the opinion of a medical expert by independently evaluating medical evidence, but must summon another medical expert to evaluate and interpret the evidence. The regulations make clear, however, that an administrative law judge not only can, but must independently evaluate the record evidence, both medical and non-medical, in making the legal determination of a claimant's residual functional capacity. The administrative law judge properly performed that role in this case. The administrative law judge accommodated the demonstrated limitations that Ms. Ross had demonstrated by providing that she should not have to work more than a limited amount of light work. He accommodated her difficulties with her legs by providing a sit-stand option, and the demonstrated difficulties with her carpal tunnel syndrome by providing manipulative restrictions. A vocational expert testified that even with these limitations, Ms. Ross could work as a telemarketer, information clerk, and security monitor. The record evidence thus provided a substantial basis for the ALJ to conclude that Ms. Ross could perform a significant number of jobs in the national economy and therefore was not entitled to benefits. Because the ALJ's decision was supported by substantial evidence, this court should uphold the agency's determination and reverse the decision of the district court. If this court has no questions for the government, we will reserve the remainder of our time for rebuttal.
Okay.
And I thank you very much.
Okay, Mr. Schultz.
Good morning, Your Honor. Barry Schultz on behalf of the plaintiff, LaFrancis Ross. The district court in this case found that the ALJ could not independently interpret medical evidence. This court has held that, made that same finding in several cases. I think perhaps most succinctly in the case of Bauzo versus Bowen, cited in the brief, this court said that neither the commissioner nor the court was capable of making a residual functional capacity assessment based on bare medical findings alone. Certainly the ALJ is supposed to review and analyze the entire record, but an ALJ, not being a doctor or an expert in the area, has no independent knowledge of what limitations might be caused by a given impairment. In this case, there was one particular functional capacity assessment by the state agency physician. But that doctor said that this claimant, who had severe carpal tunnel syndrome as well as peripheral neuropathy in the fingers, could lift 50 pounds for up to one-third of the workday and had no manipulative limitations. That opinion was clearly contrary to the medical evidence and contrary to the treating physician's conclusion. although the treating physician did not give a specific functional capacity assessment. So the ALJ, as the commissioner acknowledged in her brief, reasonably rejected the state agency physician's opinion. But that left this record with no medical assessment of what a person who's suffering from severe or moderately severe carpal tunnel syndrome in both hands could reasonably be expected to perform. Now, sometimes on a record, a claimant will testify as to how much they can lift, or they may have told their treating doctor how much they could lift, or their daily activities might indicate that they could lift more than they testified to. The commissioner, in her brief, seems to indicate that that's the case in Ms. Ross's claim. Ms. Ross testified that she was limited to lifting 5 pounds, and after carrying even 5 pounds, her hands ache. When she testified about her daily activities, she basically testified that she did no lifting. She went grocery shopping, but she didn't carry the groceries. She did laundry, but she didn't carry the laundry either up downstairs or upstairs. She did some cooking, but if there was any pot that was heavy, somebody else had to lift it for her. She did a part-time job, which the ALJ found was non-competitive because she was hired by a friend. She was at the hair salon 20 hours a week, but was only paid $75. And she testified that she actually only did about an hour to an hour and a half worth of work every day when she was there. She also said that she ordered supplies, but when the supplies came in, she didn't put them on the shelves because she couldn't. Somebody else had to do that. So there was nothing in Ms. Ross's testimony or in her statement of her daily activities that indicated that she ever lifted anything more than 5 pounds, and she testified that she was restricted to that amount of weight. So on what basis did the ALJ find that Ms. Ross could lift 10 pounds? He doesn't provide any basis. He just arbitrarily chose 10 pounds as opposed to 6 pounds or 7 pounds or 15 pounds. Not being a doctor, he doesn't know how much this claimant should have been able to lift. If he felt that her testimony was not credible, which he appears to have done, that would perhaps be a basis for not crediting her testimony concerning 5 pounds. But he still needs a legitimate medical basis, as this court found in the Green versus Apfel case, for making some type of finding as to her functional capacity. The same thing goes with the judge's finding, the ALJ's finding, that this claimant could use her hands for one-third of the workday for fine manipulation and one-third of the workday for gross manipulation. Now, the treating doctor's notes indicate that Ms. Ross was losing her fine motor control. She was dropping objects. She had trouble holding objects. She testified that she had, at the time of the hearing, she was wearing splints or braces on both hands all night long and most of the day, but she couldn't do any of her housework when she wore those braces. So she would go home. She said about 2 o'clock in the afternoon, she would take her hand braces off and try to get some housework done. That's not the activity of somebody who's able to sustain use of their hands for two-thirds of the workday, as this ALJ found. But again, there's no medical opinion on which the ALJ based his conclusion as to what this claimant could perform. Additionally, the ALJ made inconsistent findings concerning the plaintiff's ability to sit, stand, and walk. He found, and included in his hypothetical question to the vocational expert, that Ms. Ross could sit for 6 hours a day, could stand for 6 hours a day, and could walk for 6 hours a day. He made a later finding, which he also included in his hypothetical question to the vocational expert, that Ms. Ross required a sit-stand, the ability to sit or stand at her will or at her option. Those two findings cannot be reconciled, and they're inconsistent. So this court can't tell whether the vocational expert was relying on the ALJ's finding that Ms. Ross could sit for 6 hours a day and stand for 6 hours a day, or relying on the finding that she had the sit-stand option. In Allen versus Sullivan and Peterson versus Chater, this court has recognized the inconsistency in finding that a claimant both requires a sit-stand option and has the ability to sit or stand for extended periods of time. As I believe that the ALJ's finding in that regard is an internal inconsistency, the matter should be, the district court's opinion should be upheld on that basis. The commissioner in her brief indicates that the ALJ took into consideration Ms. Ross's leg pain by finding this sit-stand option. But the commissioner cites several medical texts which indicate that peripheral vascular disease with intermittent claudication causes pain in the legs on walking. Well, a sit-stand option, that a person needs the ability to sit or stand as needed, says nothing about the person's ability to walk. And this ALJ found that Ms. Ross could walk for 6 hours a day, despite the fact that he found that she suffers from peripheral vascular disease and intermittent claudication, again, which by its very nature causes significant pain on walking. The commissioner also asserts that the testimony of the vocational expert supports the ALJ Step 5 finding. The plaintiff argued that the ALJ failed to follow the requirements of ruling 004P, and the commissioner has argued that plaintiff waived that argument because it wasn't raised at the district court below. The cases, however, that the commissioner cites are cases where the appellant is raising issues before this court that weren't raised below. Plaintiff raises the issue concerning 004P in response to the commissioner's argument and as a defense to the commissioner's argument that this vocational expert's testimony sufficiently supports the ALJ's decision. The ruling specifically says that an ALJ, as part of his duty to develop the record, has an affirmative obligation to ask the vocational expert whether there's a conflict between his or her testimony and the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. The ALJ did not ask the vocational expert that question in this case. Two of the three jobs that the vocational expert cited are semi-skilled jobs according to the Dictionary of Occupational Titles. The ALJ found that this plaintiff could not perform her past work and had no transferable skill. Therefore, Ms. Ross could not perform a semi-skilled job because she doesn't have any skills which could be transferred to do that work. The vocational, the only other job remaining was a job in which the vocational expert said there were only 800 in the whole Chicago metropolitan area, the security monitor job, and the ALJ did not make a finding that the mere 800 jobs was a significant number in the economy.
If on remand the district court says that on remand the ALJ must consider the effect of any of Ross's additional evidence on his assessment of her residual functional capacity, what does that include? What would that include?
The plaintiff actually filed a motion for remand as well as motion for summary judgment in this case and included additional evidence which had been submitted to the Appeals Council. It was records from later on in 2002 and in 2003, records which treatment notes which indicate that the plaintiff's surgery, the carpal tunnel surgery, actually didn't take and that the plaintiff was having continuing and even worsening problems in the right hand than she had before the surgery.
Isn't there a different procedure for that kind of a remand, though? Doesn't the district court retain jurisdiction in order to get the additional evidence?
That's correct. That would be normally considered a sentence 6 remand versus a sentence 4 remand, and in this case, Judge Conlon seems to have mixed the two together. She didn't separately rule on the motion to remand in this case. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, thanks. Just what about
Thank
the
you.
Procedure on a remand?
Correct. Regarding additional evidence, in a sentence for remand, this court made clear in Campbell versus Sullivan that even when issuing a sentence for remand, as long as the court is remanding the case to the agency, it can go ahead and consider any additional evidence, even if the court has not made the findings pursuant to sentence 6. So even with a sentence for remand, it's fine for a court, a district court or a court of appeals, to say that on remand, by the way, agency, you should consider additional evidence, even if the sentence 6 requirements have not been met or demonstrated. And that's Campbell versus Sullivan. It was cited both in the district court's opinion and in our brief. So it is fine in either context for the agency to consider additional evidence on remand. Of course, we believe that there's no need for remand because the agency's decision was supported by substantial evidence and therefore should be upheld on that basis. And the district court's decision should be reversed. We believe that most of the arguments, all of the arguments, in fact, that my opposing counsel has brought up were adequately addressed in the briefs, and therefore, if this court has no further questions for the government, we will rest on the arguments in the briefs.
Okay, fine. That case will be taken under advisement.